Tonight on Arena, John Carney on the true life stories in season 2 of Modern Love and Doug Fishbone on Please Gamble Responsibly, his exhibition at the Crawford Gallery. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Modern Love, Amazon's anthology series based on the popular New York Times column of the same name, is coming back for a second season, drawn from a new set of Modern Love columns and a few other things besides. Season 2 takes the stories outside New York City for the first time and includes, once again, another amazing cast. Tobias Menzies, Sophie Okonedo, Minnie Driver, Kit Harington, Lucy Boynton and Jack Rayner. And that's only scraping the surface of the amazing actors that are involved in this season. Delighted to be joined by the series creator, John Carney, to tell us more about this new season. But I suppose, John, when a column like Modern Love is out there, which obviously just tells these real life stories of how love blossoms or fails or whatever happens, there are an infinite number of love stories to be told. Is that what sent you back to a second season? You just felt there's more here, there's more here.
Exactly. I mean, it was kind of like a vault that we opened of stories, but also like it felt even more timely now to sort of, you know, to come out with something that was positive and uplifting and funny and a bit different. And also, exactly as you say there, the bottom line of this show is that these are stories based on real people. Mm-hmm. You know, that these things happened. And it's nice to hear eight stories of real, you know, that like of not happy endings, because these are not Hollywood stories, as you say, but they're like, there's an uplift to them and there's a positivity to them after these 18 months of you know, awfulness that we've been going through.
For sure, they're not all Hollywood endings. You definitely had me in floods of tears for one of the episodes, which you wrote and directed yourself, in fact, and I was in a bad way watching it. 38 minutes long, I'd say there were not tears in my eyes for about 37 of those 38 minutes.
I'm sorry I made grown men cry this afternoon, but I'm the same. I'm like a sucker for that episode, and yeah, it gets me every time.
Yeah, well, let's talk specifically about that episode, because this is an example of one of the stories that's been told that takes it outside of New York City. It's a setting. The setting this time is in and around. I know it to be Enniskerry, but it's somewhere in Wicklow. It's an Irish setting. Was it originally a story set in somewhere in America that you transposed, or what happened?
Yeah, it was set in America. And, it, you know, I had this idea that we might try in season 2 to sort of move away from New York for a couple of episodes, just more than anything to really show audiences that this show wasn't about any city, and that I felt like if I made a second season exclusively in New York, it would definitely identify the show as a New York show. And I did not want to do that, because I really wanted the characters to be the main sort of focus of the show, and I didn't want to kind of get crowded with any city being a particular character. So I decided to move three of them in the end outside the States, and this just happened to be one.
Yeah, yeah. So the character of Stephanie in this episode, played by Minnie Driver, has a car, and As the episode starts, we just know she has this amazing car, a Stag, isn't it, that she has, that she absolutely adores. Are you a lover of vintage cars yourself, or did you have to go off finding out all about this type of thing?
No, I unfortunately, and to my partner's chagrin, unfortunately have a little bit of a thing for the old cars. And it's a love-hate relationship. They break down. They leak oil. You can't leave them outside in the street because they rust. They're an absolute pain in the neck. And they're a money pit. And they serve very, very few. I mean, there's a line in the script, which is a famous vintage line, vintage car enthusiast line, which is, you know, the two best days with a vintage car, the day you buy it, and the day you sell it. And that is very true. But I do. I have an old Merc and I've had old cars. We had an old Merc in Bachelor's Walk years ago.
Yeah. Funny you should...
Yeah, so there is a... I do have a thing.
Yeah. Funny you should mention Bachelor's Walk in the midst of all of this, because the vintage line that you just mentioned is uttered by Keith MacAirlane, who plays a mechanic in this particular episode. There's also a character played by Don Witcherly. He has a relationship with the Mini Driver character. I don't want to give too much away in terms of where all that is heading and going.
Yeah, good idea.
And then there's the car buyer, the guy. So, because Stephanie, Mindy Driver's character, comes to the decision that she has to sell this car. And who comes along to buy it? Only the Bowl, Simon Delaney. Let's have a listen to the scene between Mindy Driver and Simon Delaney around this car.
The brakes are slow, so you're alert, predicting things before they happen. Steering's rack and pinion. The bushings are pretty worn, so it's basically like driving a go-kart. I mean, you'd need to get that fixed if you do buy it, but, you know, you probably won't.
Well, you certainly know your stuff for a lady.
Yeah, well, you'll need to get your blood pressure checked, because these cars were designed for a much younger man.
Apologies. No, it's just that my wife and my daughters have zero interest, whereas my son and I, we'll tinker all afternoon, every Sunday.
My husband taught me everything I know about this car.
All right. He's an enthusiast too.
Him? No. My first husband.
Oh.
He bought this car when he was a student. Yeah, I saved every penny, worked two jobs through college. He made sure I understood it before he'd let me near it. Or anyone.
I mean, if you were to come down to 4,700, we could have a deal. What do you think?
Really?
Look, are you sure you want to sell this car?
Yeah.
Mini Driver and Simon Delaney there in a scene from season two of Modern Love, and the showrunner John Carney with me on the programme this evening. And indeed, you wrote and directed that particular episode yourself, John. You said to me that it was originally a story set in New York. Did you have much tinkering to do with it to transpose the setting? Because I guess Modern Love exists everywhere, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, that's it, exactly. That's the point, you know, that it's The lovely sort of succinct nature of these essays when they appear in the New York Times, because they've got a great editor called Daniel Jones, who sort of is very, very good at sort of boiling these essays down to their sort of main ingredients. And he manages very cleverly to sort of take geography and culture and out of the equation, and to try and sort of boil these things down to their sort of fundamentals. So actually, you know, this is a show that could kind of be made anywhere, and sort of as long as it's a city. I think that's the one thing that we decided in this show, was that really what Modern Love means, for me anyway, sort of, because you have to sort of define what those things mean when you're making a TV show. All it really means is the word modern in that show, for me, means that we go to these cities, these modern sort of metropolis-shaped cities, full of people that we don't know, and we leave villages or towns, or we gravitate towards these big, huge places. And the people we meet, we wouldn't necessarily choose to meet, and the boys and girls and men and women that we fall in love with over the years are not the ones that we would necessarily define in a dating app or something like that. We don't choose to meet the people that we meet in cities. They choose us, and the city in some way plays a role. Whatever that city is, whether it's Dubai or Dublin or London or New York, the city chooses to throw the people in together.
Yeah.
And what's amazing when you start asking people, particularly in big cities like New York, how did you guys meet? It's always an accident. Whereas in a village, or, you know, the traditional ways of meeting people were, you know, a matchmaker, or I had my eye on her or him since we were in high school because we lived in this small town. And you kind of get to choose who you go with.
Yeah.
And the city changes that, and it forces you to say yes a million times a day in the way that you wouldn't choose for yourself. Because you have, in order to work in a city and live in a city, you have to say yes, and you have to cooperate, and you have to get down, and you have to figure things out. And that for me, that's sort of what the essence of this show is. It's people that have come to the big city, and that city is interchangeable as long as it's a big sort of metropolis, and it's the stories that we wouldn't choose for ourselves.
Yeah, and I suppose, and I know there'll be people saying, "Ain't it scary? Isn't a city?" But the point about this, and the point about Stephanie's character, the Minnie Driver character, in the midst of all of this, is that she's working. You know, we know that she's working in a big city nearby, and that she's living partly not too far away. So the countryside is vital to the car story. But I leave it there with that one for the time. We'll leave it there with that one for the time being, because I don't want to give anything away on that, and I want several other people to cry while they watch it, like I did this afternoon. You mentioned, John, about this idea of, you know, people meeting by accident. Nowhere is that more obvious in some ways than in the other episode that you have directed here. Strangers on a Train, is that, if that's the correct title, but basically that gives us the basis of the story. Lovely idea. March the 13th, 2020, very specific date for the opening of this piece.
Yes, exactly. Well, we made this second season just before the pandemic. We kind of picked our episodes, and then we started writing, and then it was March, and we paused production, and we figured out, is there any way we can make this show? And while we were sort of in that limbo stage, like everybody else, we felt that, like, it would be crazy to make this show in a bubble and say, if we made the whole show without acknowledging even the pandemic, it would feel like it was a fantasy show and we were living in some sort of Hollywood bubble. And at the same time, we didn't want to make a show that was overshadowed by COVID in every episode, with people with masks on, and because that is the last thing in the world that needs any more coverage.
Yeah.
It's been 18 months. I don't think people are going to want to tune off Primetime and RTE onto Amazon to watch another show about COVID. But at the same time, we felt like we'd be remiss not to meet it head on in some shape or form. And that episode appeared in the New York Times. Two people meet in a train. They exchange they don't exchange numbers because they think their connection is so incredible that they don't need to. And they'll meet up in 2 weeks on the train back. And then the pandemic hits. And that was all I had in that essay. It wasn't an essay. It was actually a tiny love story, they're called. So it was just a hint. And as William Trevor, the great short story writer, used to say, you know, I'd sit in a bench and I'd overhear a couple and they'd be rowing and I'd be looking for an idea for a short story. And once I heard one line, I would go back up to my apartment to write. And I wouldn't overstay my welcome on the bench listening, because then I'd get too much information. So the point being, as a writer, all we're really looking for is a hint.
Yeah.
Is a trigger to start us off rolling. And for me, that was a great starting point, and a great way of looking at the COVID thing without it being about COVID. Yeah.
It's lovely the way you tease the story out. What we get essentially is, you know, a young couple, young woman and man meet on the train. Kit Harington is playing the male character. He's on his way up to Dublin to spend time with his brother before COVID kicks in and everybody's locked down. And in the meantime, the character played by Lucy Boynton, she's on her way up to spend time in Dublin with her mother before the lockdown kicks in. But they don't exchange numbers, as you say. So let's listen to a scene where the Kit Harington character is Jack Rayner plays his brother in this, Kit is arriving at Jack's house, and they're kind of having a chat about this woman that he's met on the train, and it cuts from that to the house in Stony Batter where Lucy Boynton is with her mother, played by Miranda Richardson. But the first voice you'll hear here is Jack Rayner as the brother of the man on the train.
If you don't have her phone number, how are you going to do some sexting?
I don't want to do some sexting. She's a modern woman.
Isn't that the whole point of having a mobile phone, though?
Yes, that's the entire reason they were invented, sexting.
This was a complex connection, not some teen hookup on the train. She is amazing.
I'll be the judge of that. What's she studying?
She's a medievalist.
Okay. So, like, Game of Thrones and stuff? Cool. I'm starting to like this girl.
It's nearly 2 years that you've been at college and you haven't met anyone. I'd slept with the entire faculty within 2 months.
What?
I'm joking. It was more like a semester.
Oh, God. Right, I'm gonna make up my room.
No, already done.
Oh,
fresh.
Thank you.
I opened a window.
Thank you.
Jack Rayner, Kit Harington, Miranda Richardson and Lizzie Boynton there in that scene from one of the other stories in Modern Love that John Carney speaking to me about this evening. Now, John Carney, was the Kit Harington, was the Game of Thrones line uttered by Jack Rayner in there, was it there before or after you cast Kit Harington?
Well, I'll be honest, I'd love to say I put it in afterwards, but no, it was in before he was involved. And the joke originally in my mind was that, like, because, you know, my idea was like that to medievalist scholars, the idea that Game of Thrones is a way in for them to medievalism was funny in and of itself, because, you know, like the idea that TV, that the Jack Rayner character, all he thinks of when he thinks of medievalism is Game of Thrones, yeah, was in and of itself funny. And then when Kit came on board, I left the line in and we did a read through and I thought, let's see if he wants me to cut out the line. And I presume Kit Harington would say that line is a bit weird for me to read, given that I was the lead in Game of Thrones. And he read it and it was so funny and he was so up for it that it sort of told me more about Kit than anything else that he did, which was that he was like totally able to like have a joke at his own expense. Funny and like self-aware, but not in a you know, cut the line. He was just a really good, fun guy to work with. I mean, him and Jack are electric together. Like, I could make a film about those two guys. And I could also make a film, actually, about Lucy and her mum. That was what I liked about that. That episode was that both stories seemed like they were good enough on their own to make a whole episode out.
Well, given you know, the Bachelor boys, the Bachelor's Walk boys, and the Jack Rayner and Lucy Boynton back in there again, you know, and it seems as if you like to go back to the actors that you've worked with in the past. But just as we finish up, John, maybe I could ask you about the new musical based on the life of George Gershwin, produced by Martin Scorsese. Is that, what stage are you at with that now?
That we are casting at the moment. I'm not allowed by threat of death to tell you who they are yet, but I've got a couple of people attached to it, and we are putting the finishing touches to the casting, and then we go out in January to shoot that in New York.
Right. Well, listen.
And that's a dream. Like, that's talk about like the look of the Irish. That's like getting a phone call from Martin Scorsese and Erwin Winkler 2 years ago to say they'd seen Sing Street.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this Jack Rayner and somebody else spoofing me? Because it does sound very like these producers. And how they got to see Sing Street, I have no idea. But they were like, do you want to make a film about Gershwin? And I happen to be a massive Gershwin fan. So I put a pitch together and pitched it back to them, fully thinking that they would say, good luck, right, okay, we've ticked that box and gotten rid of that guy. And they greenlit it. And then a year later, we had a script and a treatment. And so it's a real, really, really interesting project. I can't wait to get stuck into it.
Yeah, and I can't wait to talk
about having good... Like talking about having good music for a film,
yeah.
George Gershwin.
Like. Yeah, yeah, because the music is very notable in both your episodes as well, but we don't have time for that. I look forward to speaking to you when you can tell me more about the Gershwin project. And you know, John, sometimes you make your own luck, you know. And I think Sing Street once and a few other projects might have been part of that luck. Lovely to speak with you this evening.
Thank you. Good to talk to you. Take care.
And congrats on season 2 of Modern Love. That's John Carney there on Modern Love. Series 2 will be available on Amazon Prime from Friday, August the 13th. While the pandemic has occupied all of our lives for almost 2 years now, the shadow of the housing crisis and the economic crash that caused it is never far away from our consciousness and still creates such an obstacle for many people trying to get on with their lives. Well, an exhibition at the Crawford Gallery in Cork welcomes visitors into a ghost estate plunked right in the middle of the gallery floor. It's part of American artist Doug Fishbone's work, Please Gamble Responsibly. Within the structure, Doug also presents a film which shows that all this economic boom and bust cycle is tied up in how money works. Doug's exhibition opened back in May, only to close due to the pandemic, but now it's back. And Doug is back in Cork, and I'm delighted to say that he joins us this evening from our Cork studios. This ghost estate that you've reconstructed in the midst of the Crawford Gallery, Doug, it is based on an actual ghost estate. Tell us about the actuality of the real place.
Yeah, there's an actual estate not far from Cork City, which is very fortunate, because when I came over to do some research, I didn't know about it. But someone at the gallery told me I was prepared to go find some place in the middle of God knows where there was only one bus a day and the bus that left earlier than the one that got there. So I wouldn't have been able to make it. But yeah, there's one right outside the city called Castle Lake, and it's in Carrigtwohill. And it's quite an amazing structure. In fact, you know, much of the area is fine, but there's this one area that of the development that was just never finished because the funding ran out, you know, in the bust.
Yeah, and when it was said to you, oh, there's a ghost estate just out the road, Doug, you might want to go and have a look. What were your expectations, and then what was the reality of what you saw when you got there?
Well, I really didn't have any idea of it visually, so I just went out on the bus and. And I was totally stunned by what I saw. It's an amazing structure. And because it's left in a sort of, you know, I guess, intermediate state, I don't know what it would have looked like if it was finished according to the plans. But it had such a menacing energy to it. And I was really stunned. And I thought, wow, that is going to be the basis of the project. It was one of those kind of eureka moments that... Wow, that's the one I need.
Yeah, and the section of the estate that you're talking about, is there a part of the estate that you drove through that looks perfectly normal with people living in it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's I don't want to malign the place. There's just one portion of it that was left unfinished.
A menacing energy, you said. Doug.
I would say that because there, you know, there's this angle that one sees when you enter from the main road, which was the kind of view that really got me. And that was the kind of point of view that I tried to recreate in the gallery.
So where did you get the corrugated iron that you then brought into the gallery to try to recreate this menacing energy?
I'm not sure where that came from, because we also have a working street lamp. So thankfully, the wonderful fabricators, a company called Triangle that are in Cork, managed to source out everything we needed for it. But the corrugated iron is amazing. It gives it a really... very odd feeling when you enter the gallery, because it's about head height and, you know, blocks off the actual structure.
So we have the corrugated iron blocking off the structure itself. We have this street lamp in the midst of the refabricated ghost estate in the Crawford Art Gallery. What else have you got in there to recreate the energy that you felt on that day?
I mean, we have some broken windows and some various things, some kind of... places that would have been little terraces. You know, it's a very complicated structure, the original one. You know, it's quite immense. And so I wanted to kind of recreate different passages of it, I guess, architecturally in the sculptural build that we did. And so the great thing was working with a company like we did, which generally usually work in the theater, you know, film and theater kind of industry. They built the entire thing as a facade, which I think... looks great, and also really ties into the idea of the piece more broadly, which is, you know, what's really going on in the economy? Does it operate the way we think it's operating, or is it to some degree itself just a kind of bizarre facade?
Yeah. Is there anything going on behind that lovely wall?
Where's the Wizard of Oz hiding here? You know, we're looking for him.
And can we find the Wizard of Oz, which is another whole question in itself. So in the midst of all of this, then, we get to see your short film. Mm-hmm. I want to listen to a clip from the film. And if listeners can imagine now that because it's Doug's voice that's narrating here in a very matter-of-fact fashion, if I may say that. So we'll hear Doug narrating, but you've got to imagine images that flash up on screen. Some of them timed very interestingly with the script, I have to say.
Yeah, it's like a kind of a PowerPoint slideshow kind of visual format, but with my voice sort of rooting the imagery.
Yeah, so we have a smiling Ronald Reagan at one point during this clip, a smiling Bertie Ahern at the Galway Oasis.
Yeah. He makes a few appearances.
He does. There are serial killers. Tony Soprano was there. Chinese triads, pictures of members of that particular organisation or those organisations there as well. A few recognisable faces from the Irish banking industry, mm-hmm. and some chickens. And some chickens that are absolutely over-injected and swollen beyond recognition. I kind of wondered, what have they been eating? But no, they've been over-injected. So those are the kind of pictures that we have. And this is what Doug Fishbone is narrating to us as we look at those images flying past us.
Strangely, at exactly the same time as all this deregulation was unleashed, there was a tremendous surge in the number of serial killings. Maybe there was something in the water back then. In any case, the more money loaned out for mortgages, the more house prices go up. They basically move in lockstep. The more prices go up, the more people need to borrow so as not to miss the boat. Or the more they borrow against the rising value of their homes to buy stuff, or even another property. Developers pile in, construction jobs boom, everyone's off to the races. When the action is really good, even the mob gets involved. Bloomberg reported that up to 7.5% of the rise in house prices in 2019 in Vancouver, one of the hottest real estate markets in the world at the time, could be attributed to Chinese triads laundering drug money through property investments. But if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. And so things get too overheated, people start to default on their payments, the easy credit dries up, and like a chicken jacked up on steroids, it all keels over.
And that's Doug Fishbone as he narrates the short film in his exhibition, Please Gamble Responsibly, which is currently on show at the Crawford Gallery in Cork. As I'm listening to that, Doug, I felt this afternoon when I was looking at the short film itself. There was one part of me that was laughing gloriously at the wonderful satire of this. Then about 10 seconds later, there was a part of me who wanted to scream and roar at the screen.
Sure, yeah.
Because of the reality of what you're saying as well. I presume you're kind of playing with both those emotions on the part of the viewer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I like to use a kind of stand-up comedy kind of approach, but that's very much a kind of invitation for viewers to stay with the piece and, you know, listen to what's unfolding. Mm. But yeah, it's really maddening. I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to buy your house and then have the market crash and to be left in negative equity. And I mean, all these things that, you know, absolutely devastating to one's life. And, you know, to look now and see how these house prices are, you know, spiraling upwards again is really kind of alarming. Yeah. And I think there's so much. What was interesting to me was to really try to dig into the way money works. I mean, I don't purport to have an economist's understanding of it, but, you know, in looking at how the system works, it really does seem totally rigged against the little guy. And that's a maddening thing, really. It's disgraceful.
Yeah, you go right back. Oh, well, you know, you go back to the 1970s and you go back to Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Sure.
Yeah, later to be shamed and impeached, 37th president of the United States of America. And this was all about the moment at which the dollar, which had been linked to gold, taking it away from that link to gold was a hugely important moment in your analysis here.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, you know, some of the other strange statistics one comes across are intriguing. You know, looking at, obviously I'm having a bit of fun with that statistic about serial killing, you know, the rise in serial killing that kind of tracks with the same time frame as the, you know, leaving the gold standard. Or, you know, if you look at rises in obesity levels and things, you can actually draw kind of very similar graphs. But at that time, if you look at what's happened since that moment, you know, in terms of inflation, in terms of house prices and things like that, it's really just astonishing. Because, you know, prior to that, you could have spent roughly the same amount on a house. And if you were buying it in the UK for over 100 years, there was almost no house price growth. And then come Richard Nixon in that era, kaboom.
Was there something in particular about the Irish situation, though, that attracted you? I mean, you could have spoken about ghost estates in the United States
of
America.
Sure.
You could have spoken about the house prices in America in exactly the same way. And to be fair, the economics that we see here is pretty much international economics.
Sure.
But was there something specific about the Irish situation that attracted you?
I mean, because I was preparing the work for Crawford here in Cork, where I am right now, That I was, you know, specifically trying to root it to the Irish situation. But I think the film talks a bit broadly about, you know, in particular the Anglo world, because I think there seems to be a real imbalance in Anglo-American capitalism, you know, Irish, British, and U.S. That property price dynamic really went bonkers to a greater degree than in other places. And yeah, you're right. But I think also Ireland being such a small place, such a small economy, and having such a history of, you know, economic difficulty, and then just propelling it's a quite an amazing story, that astonishing growth in the Celtic Tiger era, and then the collapse. And, you know, I mean, Ireland strikes me as a very interesting economic case because of its reliance on, you know, financial shenanigans, kind of broadly defined, you know, tax shelters and, you know, corporate type of situations where, you know, income tax is deferred. So it's a really interesting thing to me, like a small country like Ireland could have become so wealthy and then have it backfire so quickly.
But had you any discomfort in that regard then, given that you were going to come in and take a look at the Irish economy and be pretty critical of, as you have just been there, of the way some people would say that it works? You know, it's easy for you to come in, I suppose, and say, here's you've got wrong. But there are lots of other places, particularly your own home country, where you could have done exactly the same. Were you uncomfortable with that?
I think the primary country in the world for money laundering is the United States. You know, I have no pretensions about that, but it's, you know, because I was doing a project in Ireland, I wanted to do something that I thought would resonate, because it's recent history, but it isn't. I mean, it feels distant and recent at the same time. I think all over the world, you know, the effects of that financial crisis in 2008. And now, of course, with the COVID pandemic, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, how did the pandemic, in fact, which it delayed the show's opening, as I said, or at least stopped it once it had originally opened, how do you think that has fed into what you're saying overall in the exhibition, Please Gamble Responsibly?
Well, I think it's very, very much a part of it, because in the research I did, what I was trying to look at was what really is behind the fuel, what fuels the boom in house prices? Like, what is it about economic policy, the way money is created and then loaned out through different institutional bodies? What is it about that really feeds into house price cycles? And I think, in particular, the response by the U.S. Federal Reserve to create a vast amount of money and pump it into the system is very, very, and this being done in the wake of the pandemic to try to stabilize things, this fueled right into that whole kind of cycle, because all of that money basically went into the purchase of assets, be they financial assets or in particular houses. So all that money that's created gets loaned out through the banking system to people buying houses. And of course, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to see that that's going to just massively inflate prices. And that's been happening. And that's happened. So I think, you know, some statistic I read was that I think almost 25% of all the dollars ever created financially, you know, by the U.S. Federal Reserve were created in 2020 in the wake of the pandemic. So if you cram all that kind of money into a system, what's going to happen? Something. And I think, as has been proven in, you know, time and again, it fuels, you know, house price bubbles.
What about then, if it was a menacing energy, was the kind of emotional response you had to that ghost estate in Cork? What is the energy or what is the emotion that you have around where we are now and in terms of where we might be in whatever number of months, years' time?
Oh, I'm kind of mystified by the whole thing, because I'm, as much as I'm a crank and a cynic, I suppose, I think I am an optimist, because I do think that, you know, what happened in this pandemic when these government entities had to create money to stabilize the system revealed something very interesting, which is that these things are flexible and can be, you know, there are policy responses to situations that, you know, that are flexible. There's no one way things have to go. And so maybe there are ways that, you know, a more creative approach to the creation of money and how it enters into the system and is loaned and distributed. Mm. Maybe there are better ways that we can move forward. Like, for instance, this idea of a universal basic income.
Yeah.
I know that's been discussed in policy circles here, and it's something I talk about in my film because it strikes me as a quite logical thing. Like, if we can create money and give it to investment banks, we can certainly create it and give it to people who are broke. And maybe there's something good that can come of that.
Yeah, and there is, as you say, a plan then, a pilot to have a universal basic income situation set up as a pilot scheme for arts works, art workers rather, in Ireland in the coming years. Doug, lovely to speak with you, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Doug Fishbone, and the exhibition Please Gamble Responsibly runs at the Crawford Gallery in Cork City through until August 29th. Lots of interest for us in the 2021 Ivor Novello Awards nominations. Irish band Fontaines D.C. nominated for Best Album Award. That's for their second album, A Hero's Death. Dublin Act For Those I Love nominated for his song Top Scheme. And Galway-born composer and conductor Eimear Noone nominated with fellow composer Craig Stewart Garfinkel for Best Original Film Score for 2x2 Overboard. In fact, I think she told us a little bit about that when she was in speaking with us just a couple of weeks. Eimear Noone, that is. Fontaines D.C., strong competition across all the categories, but in against Fontaines D.C., Leanne Lahavis is in there, as is Laura Marling and others besides. Best of luck to all of those involved. And here we are, Fontaines D.C.
Don't get stuck in the past. Say your favourite things en masse. Tell your mother that you love her. I go out of your way for others. Sit beneath the light that suits you and look forward to a brighter future. Life ain't always empty. 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 Life ain't always empty.
Oh, you could never tire of it, could you? Hero's Death from Fontaines D.C., title track from their second album, the album that has been nominated for the Ivor Novello Award for Best Album this year. Congratulations to them, to For Those I Love, and indeed to Eimear Noone. The winners will be announced on September 21st. The White Lotus follows the intertwined relationships between groups of wealthy holidaymakers at a fictional Hawaiian resort and the staff that are in charge of catering to their every whim. An ensemble cast that includes Jennifer Coolidge, Connie Britton, Steve Zahn and Molly Shannon. The dark satire puts big spending guests under the microscope. Very popular with TV viewers already in the United States. So much so, in fact, that a green light has already been given to the second series, but we're just about to get a look at series one, and Jen Gannon is previewing it for us this evening. We just said to you, as we were listening to Fontaines D.C. there, really this series is a kind of, they couldn't do Downton Abbey in America.
Yeah, exactly.
So they kind of, they gave us the upstairs, downstairs kind of feel that Downton Abbey
definitely
has in a Hawaiian resort in contemporary America. That's what we have here.
I mean, as I said, paradise has never looked so grim. Like, I mean, these are the kind of people that would look down on the Mar-a-Lago set. They're seen as above them. So, but also, it's a bit Fawlty Towers. There's a little bit of that in it because there is that kind of broad farce at the beginning even. But I think there's something about it. I know a lot of people watch Below Deck, the reality show, which is about a crew that man a luxury yacht. And in The White Lotus, you are witness to what happens behind closed doors and you hear what the employees really think of their, you know, pampered guests. And there's a lot of that in it. And I really think there is this exacting nature of the hospitality industry that is ripe for satire because it does bring out the worst in people. It actively encourages guests to behave in this very greedy, grasping manner. And, you know, it's written by Mike White and he loves to delve into that kind of sensibility where he likes the bitter end of things. He likes to study obnoxiousness, self-centeredness, enlightenment, belligerent narcissism, which this has in spades.
It certainly has.
I think anyone who, you know, relishes the reprehensible behaviour of the Roy family in Succession, which I do, or the shady behaviour that we saw, the duplicity in something like The Flight Attendant this year, they will be into the themes of this and how it's drawn out, the story's drawn out.
I want to stick with the kind of the downstairs bit for initially, at any rate. Armand is played by Murray Bartlett here, Australian actor.
Yeah.
What would we know him from?
He was in HBO's Looking, the gay drama. It was centered around a group of gay men. He was really good in that. But also, I think a lot of people know him as the shoe guy from Sex and the City. He was this Australian shoe buyer who Carrie had this crazy night with at Bungalow 8. And a lot of people remember him from that. And this is a star-making role for him, I really think. It'll boost him into the mainstream.
Yeah, he's the kind of the manager or the
highly strong, we will say. Very panicked.
And let's have a listen to the advice that he's giving to a new employee here, Lanny, played by Jolene Purdy. And this is how you behave in the presence of the guests.
Look, Lanny, I know it's your first day on the job, and I don't know how it worked at your other properties, but here, self-disclosure is discouraged. Especially with these VIPs who arrive on the boat. You know, you don't want to be too specific as a presence, as an identity. You want to be more generic.
Generic?
Yes. You know, it's a Japanese ethos where we are asked to disappear behind our masks as pleasant, interchangeable helpers. It's tropical kabuki. And the goal is to create for the guests an overall impression of vagueness. That can be very satisfying, where they get everything they want, but they don't even know what they want, or what day it is, or where they are, or who we are, or what the fuck is going on.
Murray Bartlett there. Imagine getting that advice on the first day of your job.
I think anyone in the service industry who's ever worked in the service industry will completely understand that.
Yeah, well, self-disclosure is discouraged. White Lotus is the new television series that we're speaking about with Jen Gannon this evening. So we do get a lot of the dynamic, however, in that background group of people. And in some ways, I think I found them maybe even more interesting than the obnoxious rich people that we were introduced to.
Yeah, the dynamic there is, I mean, I think the resorts, as you see, only access this kind of heavenly retreat for some. And then for others, it's like this hell that they can never escape from. And they realise that, you know, making people's dreams come true is very thankless work. And, you know, everybody in the White Lotus is horrific, is an awful person in some way, apart from Belinda, who is the spa manager, and she's played by Natasha Rothwell, who you'd know from Insecure, another HBO show. And she kind of acts as the gentle heart of the series. So, I mean, if you hate everybody else in the series, which you will do, at least you have Belinda there to kind of steer the ship a bit. And she is the almost coddles the guests, and especially who is played by Jennifer Coolidge, who is just outstanding. I have to say, like, this, she has to win an award. She has to be nominated for this, because I think with Jennifer Coolidge, you can almost write her off and people will know her from her iconic, you know, roles as a comedian in something like, she was Paulette in Legally Blonde, and then she was obviously, you know, the MILF, Stifler's mom in American Pie. But she steals the show in this, really, because she's given this opportunity to go beyond just that broad comic stylings. And hilarious as her character Tanya is, Tanya McQuaid, or she has to call herself McQuad.
Let her introduce her own character here, because I am not going to say her second name ever in my life, and certainly not if I'm ever anywhere near Jennifer Coolidge. Here she introduces herself.
Aloha.
Are you Ms. McQuad?
Quad. One syllable.
McQuad.
Well, two syllables, but the second part is one syllable. Wad. McQuad.
Is it Gaelic?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm in desperate need of a massage. Is that possible? Is there anything available? I mean, I'd take anything right now because I have a herniated disc and I just...
Belinda behind you.
Belinda behind me.
Belinda, who is behind you, is our spa manager. Belinda, Ms. McAwad is in need of treatment. Would you have any openings for her this afternoon?
Unfortunately, we are all booked.
Oh, no. Really? Are you sure? I would really appreciate it. I'm not picky. I don't have to have deep tissue or anything. I'd take anything at this point. Anything but Reiki, of course.
And that's Jennifer Coolidge there as Tanya Mac, whatever her second name is. I'm not picky. There is not a single guest in this hotel who is not picky.
Everyone is picky. Everyone is a very flawed human. And but I think with that character, he kind of brings out this side to her where she has the two most, I think, relatable speeches in the entire series. Number one, she is mired in grief because her mother has just died and she's there ostensibly to, you know, throw her mother's ashes into the sea. So she's dealing with grief and she talks about the complex nature of her relationship with her mother. And then she also has this breakdown to Belinda, who she confides in a lot, about how difficult it is to be herself with men or trying to get into a relationship. And I think it really shows her range. And I think Mike White, you know, he's cast this cast so cleverly because it's full of like reliably good character actors who we usually only see as the best friend or the side character, who are now getting center stage. Yeah. And I think that's really important, that because I think he gives them these three-dimensional roles and everybody is subverted almost. Connie Britton is in it as this kind of CEO. She's a
the most awful family in the world.
Horrific family.
the Mossbackers,
yeah,
aren't they?
So, you know, Connie Britton, we'll know her as the kind of American mother, and she's usually the all-American mother. And in this, he kind of subverts what we know about her on TV. And she's very prickly. She's really harsh. She's very unforgiving. And then similarly, Jake Lacy, who anyone would know on Girls.
Do you want to stick with the Mossbackers just for the time being? Because really, the really interesting part of the series for me was one of the daughter Olivia here and her friend. They're on holiday because they're such a rich family. They can bring the daughter and the pal off with them.
And I think Olivia, who's played by Euphoria's Sydney Sweeney, I think her and Jennifer Coolidge were my favourites in it. And she's this performatively woke, constantly eye-rolling Gen Z college student, and she brings along her supposed best friend Paula, and they look upon every other guest with the disdain that only comes with youth and privilege. And they're absolutely terrifying, reading Nietzsche by the pool. And I think when they dig into her relationship with Paula, it's the most interesting part of the series.
You were going to mention the other, because there's a young couple here, a honeymoon couple, and again you would have to say it to Rachel Patton, who doesn't not sure whether she wants to be called Rachel, but get out of the marriage now, before the honeymoon even starts, Rachel.
Yeah. And Shane is her husband, who is played by Jake Lacy. And that's what I was saying about Mike White trying to subvert what we think we know about these actors, character actors, because Jake Lacy is known for his role in Girls and his role in Obvious Child, where he plays this kind of sweet, good guy character. And this, he is supremely selfish. He is the son of a very rich parents, and he's completely pampered and wants to get his own way.
Yeah, and they paid for the honeymoon. They're in the wrong room, and he's not at all happy about this. But
and
in episodes,
torments Armand and demanding what he thinks he deserves.
But in episode 3, you're on your honeymoon, and who arrives but the mother-in-law?
I'm crazy. I'm so sorry. I'm totally crazy, I know. I was just so tense from the wedding and all the weeks leading up to it. I know you were too. And then Kathy Clement, I swear this was Kathy Clement's idea. She said, we should do a spa week at the Mauna Kea. And of course, that sounded amazing. And then I talked to you on the phone, honey, and you sounded so upset. You had me worried. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll just pop over and see you guys for a second and give you a little love and then be on my way and go meet Kathy at the Mauna Kea. Please don't be mad at your mother-in-law.
Oh, my God, of course not. I'm not mad. I'm really, really happy to see you.
Oh, good. That makes me so happy. This is a really nice view. It's a really nice room. But it's definitely not the room I booked.
Trust me, I know.
Why did they give you this room, I wonder?
Mother, don't even start.
It's a touchy subject, huh?
Yeah.
I can't believe my baby boy is married. I can't believe it. Oh. I am so glad we had so many cameras. The whole thing is an absolute blur. I don't remember anything. Do you? Do you? And Rachel, you were such a beautiful bride, but also very pale. But now you have a little more colour and it looks great.
Oh, you don't let that one go, whatever you do. That's Rachel Patton is played by Alexandria Daddario, who we hear there, Jake Lacy as the son. And it's the mother-in-law of the daughter that arrives, by the way, unless I wasn't clear, played by the wonderful Molly Shannon. You loved this series, I think.
Yeah, I think for anybody, I mean, it's got a brutal edge to it. So I think if you enjoy that kind of satirical comedy, you'll you'll be a fan.
Just briefly, it starts with a murder, but it's not. It kind of, yeah, we're going to find out about that, but we don't even know who's murdered initially. It's not about that. It's about the dynamic.
It's really just, it's a satire about, basically, as Belinda says in episode two, I think it's rich people ruining the world. That's
rich
what it's about.
Ruining the world. My thanks to Jen Gannon, The White Lotus airs on Sky Atlantic from Monday, the 16th of August. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.